2010 Cattlemen's College session. Appreciate your interest in this topic. I think you're going to find it a very, very enjoyable session, particularly as we look at the beef industry and the impact that the consumer has on our industry. They are the source of our dollars. They are our target. And we've got a great panel lined up to address exactly what's going on in that industry today and what will be going on in the future. I am Larry Quora with the Certified Angus Beef Program. I'll serve as your moderator today. Appreciate that opportunity and always look forward to working with the NCBA staff on Cattlemen's College. We're going to start off with a gentleman that really doesn't need a lot of introductions in Cattlemen's College. He's been on this program a number of times on a number of different topics. Dr. Darrell Tatum is a meat scientist on the staff at Colorado State University, a native Texan, considered really one of the outstanding meat scientists in the United States, and has done a lot of work in this consumer profiling, what the consumer looks for. Let's give him a good Cattlemen's College welcome as he shares some information with us.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Nice introduction. Well, it's fun to be here. You know, when I came up here, we were having all kinds of technical difficulties with computers, and they got me to work this out. And I got to tell you, that's dangerous, because if it doesn't have hair, I don't know much about it, so can't deal with it. So I'm not a computer guy. I am an animal scientist. But it's nice to be here, and I see a lot of familiar faces in the audience, and it'll be fun visiting with you. I tend to be a roamer, so I'm going to walk around. Hopefully I won't lasso a foot here and go down up on the stage, but we'll try to get this information covered with you. Our topic today for the entire session is Beef Products 2010, Meeting Consumer Needs. And so I'm going to try to set this up a little bit by looking back at what you've done as members of NCBA. Last year, you updated and reinvented your strategic plan with a target date of 2010. And the overall goal, the overarching goal for this long-range plan was to increase beef demand by 10% by the year 2010. And then your long-range strategy planning group set a list of priorities. It's a fairly short list, but pretty heavyweight list of things that they would like to accomplish to enable them to attain this goal of increasing beef demand by 10% by the year 2010. I've listed these up here, and I'm not going to stand here and read them to you, but I've underlined the first two because, to me, when we're talking about consumers, those two have some gravity to them. Both of them mention a consumer focus, and the thing that's important to me is because I see that as a signal that your industry really is transitioning, and I think we've been in that transition as a beef business for the last several years, really going from more of a commodity-based, production-oriented kind of a business structure, really to one that's more keenly attuned to what your final end-product user is telling you they want. And I think that's a significant step for this industry. I really believe that's a big-time move. And when I go back and look at your priorities that were adopted last year, I think those have a strong message attached to them. And I hope you understand that, and I hope you feel the same way about that as beef producers, because it's important to what we're going to talk about today, and it's important to the sustainability and long-term success of your programs and your businesses. But I think we are moving away from just producing something and tossing it out there and asking people to buy it. I think what you're really trying to do now as cattlemen, and what you're committed to doing, is really developing your production systems and your production strategies to really target specific consumer endpoint targets. And I think that's a significant change in the industry. So that's where I'm going to head. I want to get in the mind a little bit of consumers and talk a little bit about that.
Can I get you a movie?
Oh, sure. Our other two speakers have a lot more interaction with consumers specifically, and we'll fill in some details. But I would like to talk just very briefly about what today's consumers are thinking, what they're demanding, and so forth. This list is not an exhaustive list. If you've read any of the consumer survey data over the past several years, you know that this list just keeps continuing to grow. It's getting longer and longer. I don't have space on the screen for all of the things, but what I've tried to list are some things that I think are key drivers in terms of consumer preference and consumer demand. And I really haven't listed them in any specific order. There's a little bit of logic to the order here as we come down. But if you ask consumers today, what do you want in terms of food products, really what they want is a convenient product that's easy to prepare, that's safe and healthy, bottom line. And if you can create that with a decent price and add some value to it, great. If you talk about beef, there's some other things that go into that, and we'll talk about those as we go along. This fifth one down here is one that I'm interested in a little bit because that's kind of a new one on the screen for meat specifically. There's a lot of people now that are asking more and more questions about how their food is produced. They want to know, where does it come from, what's in it, what production practices were used to produce it and provide it. And there are a lot more people right now that are asking these kinds of questions. Some of them are related to individual values. And those are some things that I know you're reading about, but pay attention to those. I don't think it's a big, big movement yet, but it's something that is on the screen and something that people are asking a lot of things about relative to cattle. How do you handle your cattle? Are you humane in the handling? Did you provide them an adequate corral space and things like that? People are concerned about that. And they're beginning to express that concern through their food purchase decisions. So I don't think it's one of the top ones right now, but it's one you need to pay attention to and be aware of. For beef, if you look at all of the things here, and I should mention I've got price down here at the bottom because in many cases, a lot of these other things trump price. People pay more to get certain qualities and certain things attached to their food, certain promises and so forth, so they will pay a little more for it. And so many, many times these things up here will trump price. For beef, the thing that really I still think is one of the key drivers is taste. And if you ask people over and over, and this has been going on for decades, but it's always in the top few listed. And I think the reason that so many people make beef their food of choice in a dining experience, for a pleasurable dining experience, is because of taste. And so that's a bottom line that I want to talk a little bit more about. I don't want to diminish the importance of all of these other things up here, but I don't have time to talk about all of them. They're all important. But for your product, one of the key drivers is quality. And I think you need to really focus on quality in the next several years if you're going to meet that demand, increasing demand by 10% by the year 2010. Even for people who have a little different view of what they want in food products, you all know that the natural and organic market is growing very rapidly in all food products. Beef is one of them. Meat is one of them. I put this up here. Really, this is not a huge segment of the market, but it is an interesting one because even in this segment of the market where people are more interested in things like how animals were handled or how they were produced and express their buying decisions that way, even among those people, when they are asked, what would influence you to buy more meat, over three-fourths of them say, give me something that tastes good. And so again, it tends to trump several of these other things. This was a recent survey done by Whole Foods Market with their consumers, and a different clientele, same answer. So I guess I believe the taste component is fairly important. Well, how do consumers define that? What is taste to the average beef consumer? We've done a lot of work, others have too, over the years. I just presented some information that I was familiar with because it comes out of some studies we did. But various other studies show many of the same trends. When you ask a beef consumer, what sensory attribute turns you on? How do you define taste for you? Taste is kind of a generic word. There are three things that they will list typically: tenderness, flavor, and juiciness. But the one that most frequently floats to the top is tenderness. And for you as producers, that's important to know because it's one you can manage fairly effectively. You can do some things as producers, and we'll talk about those in a little while, that can help you produce a higher quality product. Because if you systematically manage cattle, you can make them more tender. Flavor, you can do some things there as well. And flavor usually is the second one ranked. In some consumer surveys, it gets up there right with tenderness and sometimes exceeds it. But I got to tell you, when you ask a consumer about tenderness, flavor, juiciness, They wad them all together. They don't discriminate like we do in the laboratory as a meat scientist. They wad them all together, and to them it's taste. But if you really want to get focused on how to improve taste, this is important to you as a producer. Generally, tenderness is kind of a bottom line thing. You're not going to have a pleasurable eating experience with beef unless you have acceptable tenderness. And even if it tastes pretty good in terms of flavor, if it's tough, they'll tune you out and turn you off. So it's kind of a price of admission relative to consumers. Experimental market research has really backed this up. And these are some interesting studies to me, because so many of the consumer work that we do involves going out with a questionnaire and giving it to somebody and saying, okay, what do you think? What are you going to buy? Tell me what you think about this product. What are you going to purchase today? And they'll tell you a lot of things that they really don't back up with actual purchases. They'll tell you kind of what's on their mind. But when you ask them to put their money where their mouth is, pun intended, it means more in terms of market research. It tells you more about what they're thinking and what they really will do. And this is a summary of several studies that have been done to try to get a focus on this. What will they really do with money? And in some of these, we actually paid people to come in and taste beef. Deb, you were involved in some of these where you gave them money, and then at the end you said, okay, now we want you to buy the meat. And when they do that, they're a little more careful about that snap decision, and they really study it a little more carefully if they're laying their money down. And what the results have showed us over the years is that superior taste, superior tenderness and flavor really increases the likelihood that they're going to buy your product. It's a direct relationship and reasonably strong relationship. So they will buy more. They're more likely to buy it. They will buy more if it tastes good. The other side of the issue is they'll pay more for it. Now, I'm not an economist. I'm an animal scientist. But I took a few economics classes, and I know if they buy more and pay more for it, that's a pretty good demand signal. And so what that really is saying, if you distill it all down, when you measure what they do with their money that you've given them and say, buy the meat, buy what you want. And in many cases, this was based on performance of the product. When you ask them to do that, they're going to buy the stuff that tastes good. So again, I think this kind of justifies what we've been saying about this being a very, very important piece of driving demand. They'll also pay more for guarantee if you're willing to provide it. And so if you can come up with something that's pre-tested, that you will stand behind and guarantee it, they're interested in that. If you go back to that Whole Foods slide that I just showed you, that was the thing that they said at the very top. Give us a guarantee of taste. We're interested in that. Give us a guarantee. So these are things that are driving today's consumers. And for beef, I think taste is still one that's fairly close to the top of the heap. I've had the privilege the last few months of being on several programs with Randy Block, who all of you know very well. And if you know Randy, Randy has a real knack for distilling down through all the BS and getting to the real message of things. And we were talking about demand and what was going on with beef demand. And many of you are aware that the beef demand index the last couple of years has slid a little bit. It's not as strong as it was. But Randy made a point that I think is one that you need to capture and take home with you. The demand for higher quality beef is still pretty strong. And it's strong domestically and globally in the markets that we're active in. And he went on to present some data. He showed some tonnage movement and so forth that I don't have up here. But one of the points he made is we've really seen over the last several years those price spreads between quality grades widen out. Now, part of that is because, as you know, we're producing less choice beef now than we have been for a while. And so part of that is a supply deal, widening those spreads. But even with higher tonnages being moved, people are paying more for these products. And so his interpretation of that is it's a fairly strong demand signal for the upper end market. The other point he made that you need to know, I think, right now food service market share represents around 50%, about half of market share currently for beef. He thinks that's going to grow. And I asked him yesterday in the airport when I ran into him, he thinks it's going to grow at a rate of about 1% per year for a while. So a fairly strong movement there. In that segment of the market, quality is a premium, and it is something that we'll have to get better at producing higher quality cattle to be able to serve, because that is a growing segment of your market. So I think the message of this is if you really want to try to increase demand over time, recognize what people are telling you they want to eat, and then try to produce the cattle that are going to deliver that. We use currently, we don't measure tenderness routinely, so we use quality grades to reflect differences in eating quality and taste in our marketplace. We got interested in looking at, you know, not so much what does tenderness do, but what does quality grade do for you in terms of consumer demand signals and willingness to buy beef and pay for it and so forth. This was another one of those experimental market research studies where we actually went out, we gathered people up, cooked the meat for them, standardized the preparation procedures and so forth, fed them the product, and then asked them to buy the meat with their money that we'd given them on a voluntary basis based on its performance. They didn't know what the grades were. All they knew is they had sampled X number of products, and they knew which ones they liked and which ones they didn't like. And then they were allowed to buy them. It was voluntary. They didn't have to purchase the beef if they didn't want to. So it was purely and simply up to them if they wanted to spend their money on the product. And what we found in all of that was that, again, marbling increased, their willingness to buy the meat increased significantly. And it was a fairly strong, not real strong, but fairly direct relationship. It was almost linear as marbling went up. But the interesting thing over here, and what this slide, this is a busy deal, but over here it has the predicted probability of a consumer bidding on a product. And the probability goes up as marbling goes up. But the significant thing to me, when I looked at all of these results, when Bill Platter got them and reported them, is where that willingness to buy shifted. And in this kind of an analysis, this line right here represents the trigger where they say, yes, I'm going to buy the meat. And that was at a marbling score of modest 50. And so if you're not familiar with grading, modest 50 would be average choice. This is modest zero right here. That's the bottom end of average choice. This is moderate zero, which is the bottom end of high choice. So what they were saying is our willingness to buy gets pretty good, but hey, bring me some premium choice and prime, and I'm real interested in buying it. And that's what they were telling me. This bar chart over here is based off of an average select bid that they actually paid for the meat. And then these are little premiums that they were willing to offer for commodity choice, premium choice, and prime. And the message is pretty clear there. You know, we're producing an awful lot of select grade beef right now in the industry. That isn't what they're telling you they want to eat. In fact, they're kind of squeamish about commodity choice. What they want is premium choice and prime. And that's what they're going to pay for. And so I'm not up here on the marbling bandwagon. I'm just telling you what they're saying. And it isn't select they're after. And so if you're going to use select, you better be doing something with it to make it more palatable, because that's not what they're interested in buying. So those to me are some pretty key consumer signals for you as beef producers. What can you do to enhance the beef eating experience? There's a lot of things a producer can do. Problem is, right now, there's not a lot of economic incentives to do all of it. And so one of the things that needs to occur sometime in the future, if you're going to meet your demand goals, is you've got to restructure a market signal that allows you to get with it and do that, and not just produce weight, which is what your market signal tells you today. So that's a key thing that needs to be looked at, I think, if you're going to meet your goals for increasing demand. You can control breed and genetic inputs. You can use feeding systems that enhance product quality. There's enough information now on growth enhancement technologies to know that they're not bad, but you need to keep the pedal off the floor when you start implanting and using growth enhancement technologies. You back it off a little bit if quality is your goal. And then there's a whole list of best management practices that can be used to avoid problems. And we'll talk about a few of those. I don't want to go into a labored discussion of all this. I do want to underline a few things with you. One of the things that you can do that probably will enhance value, product value to consumers and the eating experience as much as anything has to do with the genetic part of what you do in selection. We did a study for NCBA years ago where we threw all kinds of different post-mortem technologies at products to try to make them eat better. And it wasn't until we tinkered around with the genetic side that we actually got where we wanted to be. There's a school of thought among meat scientists that you can kind of take, you know, that old select is fine, you know, that, but all you got to do is pump it or beat it or whack it or chop it or grind it or pre-chew it or whatever you're going to do, shock it or whatever you're going to do, blow it up. There was even people exploding it for a while trying to make it tender. But I got to tell you, it's a garbage in, garbage out deal. And Glenn Dolezal's picture is up here. Many of you know Glenn, but he made the statement. I just quoted it out of Wes Ishmael's magazine article. He said, you still can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. That's right. So maybe what we need to do is make sows with silk ears so we can make the purses. Change them genetically, and you'll get there. It's worth the effort. We need to figure out how to pay producers to do that, but it will sell more beef for you if you do that, because you can wring out a lot of the unacceptable products by doing that. This is a listing of the 8 most predominant breeds in the U.S. They differ a lot with respect to their ability to marble. Their shear force, average shear force values and so forth. I don't have a dog in this fight, so I'm just listing them up here. I like several of the breeds up there, but I got to tell you, when you're out looking for quality, one of the things that you can do is you can mix and match a little bit, and you can balance strengths of breeds. We've been involved in a long-term study looking at profitability and adding value to a cow herd for a while. And one of the things we found out over the last 3 or 4 years is the kind of cattle that work best for us tend to use a lot of the maternal strengths on the British side, but they don't get big enough for us to be profitable year in, year out. And so we like them with a little bit of continental mixed in. And where they work best for us is about a 50 to 75% British and about a 25 to 50% continental. We're using some terminal crosses. We're using some hybrid bulls. Produce some percentage continental cattle, and they're working good. And they do a lot of, they tag a lot of the bases. They grow enough, they yield enough. The mothers don't have much continental in them, but a touch, but not very much. But the bulls do. And so we're getting along pretty good by mixing and matching those. Pay attention to some of the traits of these different breeds and match them up. If you're in an environment, production environment, that requires tropically adapted cattle, no problem. I grew up in the South and I understand that. I know what the production advantage is of something with a little bit of Brahman in it. Just realize as you're making your crosses that most of the research data would show that as the percentage Brahman breeding goes up, shear force goes up almost directly. Roger, this is some stuff out of Duane's lab in Florida that showed that. And recognize that and understand that and use it to your advantage. Doesn't mean you should quit using Brahman. Maybe just not use quite as much. And over time, what we found out is this shear force increase or reduction in toughness is caused by an enzyme inhibitor that prevents beef from Boss Indicus cattle, prevents them from aging normally compared with Boss Taurus cattle. They age slower. They require a longer period of time post-mortem to reach the same level of tenderness. So we know what's causing it. But we also know that it's linked to breed differences. That enzyme inhibitor is calprostatin, and we'll talk just a little bit about that as we go through. You can do so much with breeds, and then you've got to go a little step further, and you've got to get into actually trying to make the breeds different themselves. Within breed selection has been a real problem in the cattle industry because traditionally it's relied on performance records and progeny testing to be able to do it. That's a long, laborious task. All of the traits I have listed up there, shear force, marbling, calprostatin, all are heritable, more so in Boss Taurus cattle and Boss Indicus cattle for the tenderness traits, but they are heritable and you can select for improvements in tenderness. The problem is measuring all these things. There was a change just at the end of last year by USDA that I think is going to help data capture and help data flow back to producers, particularly from the standpoint of selecting for improvements in marbling. the instrument enhancement of marbling, instrument augmentation of grading, measuring marbling using video image analysis and procedures, and capturing a lot of data. If we can get it back to producers, that information is going to be invaluable to you in terms of trying to improve grade and grading ability in cattle. It'll create less subjectivity, but this is the one that I think really holds a lot of promise for producers, is being able to use the information in making your selection and management decisions. What we don't have is a real good, accurate online measurement of tenderness. There's a lot of these being worked on, and a lot of them being tested and evaluated currently. Some of them are okay. None of them are really, really, really good at the present time. But that's something that would really help us in selection for improved tenderness, improved product eating quality. Another thing that's on the horizon that is important, and I would applaud the American Gelby Association for using a new technology before we really know exactly what it's going to do for us. But they have begun releasing marker data, DNA marker data, for their 25 most widely used sires. These markers over here, this is calpostatin that we talked about earlier. These are calpain markers. These in concert control the aging curve of a piece of meat. Calpostatin is an inhibitor. If this is high, and so if you have no favorable alleles, you're going to get a flatter aging curve, and you're going to get animals that age more slowly and stay tough for a longer period of time during aging. You get animals that have some of these favorable alleles stacked up, at least in theory, you would have a very rapid aging curve. And so if you're after a threshold shear force value for, let's say, maybe 4.5 kilos here, what you're after is one of these guys that have these alleles that will rocket them down, make them tender after a short period of time. You don't have to depend on a lot of aging to have an acceptable tenderness level. So those are some pretty powerful tools. Now, how well they work is a question that all of us have. We've got bulls in our herds with marker data on them, and we're still kind of scratching our heads wondering, okay, what's it telling us? There are a lot of validation studies being conducted, and as an industry, I would encourage you to support validation of these. They're powerful tools if they work like we think they might work, but I'm not sure we're convinced how they work yet. So that would be a priority, I think, for the industry, to validate these and figure out how to use them. Feeding systems, I don't want to spend much time. You've all heard this before. The reason we feed cattle is not only to help make them more tender, but it improves the appearance of the product. The brighter color, whiter fat, have some marbling. The other thing that feeding does, it enhances flavor. You know, we haven't talked a lot about flavor, but there are some components in fat of grain-fed cattle that gives it its unique flavor, and that's what turns consumers on. So it takes about 100 days or so. Don't short feed them. Pay attention to what you're putting in their ears and in their feed in terms of growth enhancement technologies. Most of these work in an additive fashion. The more times you use them, the more response you're going to get. And so recognize that. Know that if you start stacking them throughout an animal's lifetime, you're probably going to see a little more growth and a lot more pounds over time, but you're also going to see a lot more negative quality issues associated with them. So don't use them every opportunity when the animal comes through the chute. Use them judiciously, use them when you need to, and they will help your bottom line a ton. We implant all of our cattle that we're marketing on these profit studies and so forth because we know that it's a technology that will add a lot of dollars to the cattle. But you can overdo it as well. This is a very recent study we did where we looked at effective heifer finishing implants. There's not much information on that on shear force. And what we found is these are finishing implants in the yard. One time didn't do anything. Give them twice, then you're going to see more problems. So maybe you use one instead of two. If you're going to use two, maybe there are some that work better than others. And what we found in this study that I thought was so important is it seemed to be related specifically to dosage. And as we get these dosages higher and use them in succession, the cumulative dose that we're giving these animals steps up shear force quite a bit, and so you're reducing tenderness. I saw the same kind of a trend with grade. The other thing, and the reason I put these up here that I did want to bring up with you, some of these studies, I know in the early 90s, trenbolone acetate was introduced as a hormone for use in enhancing growth in cattle, and it's been trashed time and time again relative to its effects on grade and tenderness. It didn't do that in these heifer studies that we looked at, and it was the combination of trenbolone and estrogen that did it, not trenbolone alone. And so if you're working with heifers, that TBA alone is not a bad implant to take a look at from a quality standpoint. It'll help your marbling scores a little bit. It'll help your tenderness a little bit as well. Deb, this is some of your stuff. Keep them out of the hospital. They grade better. This is right along with all of the ranch-to-rail data that's been reported. But the other thing about morbidity is it can cause eating quality problems too. This has not been documented very many times. This is some older work done at Oklahoma State by Brett Gardner, who tracked cattle and looked at them with lung lesions and without lung lesions and found that there was a significant tenderness effect. Even if you don't see that every time, health management is so important to your profitability, so important to overall product quality. It's something you need to do and do correctly to make sure that you end up with a quality product. Pre-harvest stress is something we're just now really beginning to understand the ramifications of. We've known for a long time that all of these kinds of stressors in animals will cause dark cutting beef. But now we know that some of these same things can reduce tenderness of cattle as well. I put this up here. This is a full-blown dark cutter and one that's normal. It's the cattle that are kind of between here that are real problems. They don't age right. They stay tough. And so if you have a pH range in meat of around 6 to 6.1, it's a real problem from the standpoint of tenderness. Even if you have cattle that don't express dark cutting, one of the things that we found recently is acute pre-harvest stress can cause them to be tough. You may not see very many dark cutters, but you'll see more tough cattle. This is a kind of a busy slide again. These bars represent blood lactate levels that we measured on a bunch of cattle being trucked to the plant. We monitored them at the yard, and then we trucked them to the plant and monitored blood lactate at the plant. And blood lactate in this study was used as an indicator of acute pre-harvest stress. Cattle with high blood lactate levels were kind of, and we documented it with behavior scores and things. They were nervous, flighty, just kind of worked up, lathered up when they got to the plant. And those cattle had high lactate levels, but they also were tough. And there was almost a linear relationship between blood lactate levels and tenderness. So there again, calm handling, careful handling, very important from the standpoint not only of color but also tenderness of the product. I'm going to wrap this up real quickly, but just realize that you're part of a beef chain, part of a system, and that what you do matters tremendously. And right now it's hard to get paid for that, and we need to change that signal, but it's something you need to understand, that you play a pivotal role in making something worth buying. Now, you can do everything correctly, and because you are part of a chain, somebody at the next level can hose it all up for you. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to make it right. And I think you can do a lot of things to enhance product quality. I put these down here, and I never have been here, but you guys all know Dr. Core over here. And he's a world traveler. He said, I know where that is. That's my favorite karaoke bar in Australia. So... So he's been there, done that, right? Why is it important to deliver a quality eating experience? Because people associate that with value. They'll buy more of your product and they'll pay higher prices for it, purely and simply. So if you want that demand curve to shift up, important to pay attention to that. Realize one of your products is cattle, but to the final consumer, your product's taste. So I'll stop there. Hope I didn't take too long.
Give him a 5 minutes.